This is lecture 4 of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner called According to Luke, the Gospel of Compassion and Love Revealed. Lecture 4 is entitled Formation of the Nathan Jesus Child. In the next few days, as we continue to investigate the facts underlying the Luke Gospel, we will find that they become increasingly elusive and intricate. For this reason, please keep in mind that the lectures are cumulative. The content of each lecture builds upon the last. It will prove impossible to understand an individual lecture or lectures without considering the context supplied by other lectures. Because this is especially true of today's lecture and tomorrow's, please refrain until tomorrow from asking how their content relates to other lecture cycles that touched on the same subject. We closed yesterday with the statement that the Buddha's Nirmanakaya was revealed in our world during what the Luke Gospel describes as the Annunciation to the shepherds. We said that the rejuvenated Buddhist worldview flowed into the world through Christianity when the maternal astral body separated from the adolescent Jesus and was absorbed by the Buddha's Nirmanakaya. From that moment, a specific being united the Buddha's Nirmanakaya, or spirit body, and the maternal astral body that surrounded the boy Jesus until age 12. This fact raises the following issue. Ordinarily, when the maternal astral body separates from a growing human being, and the young person's own astral body is born, the maternal astral body dissolves into the general astral world. In our current evolutionary cycle, the maternal astrality surrounding an ordinary human being could not possibly receive a being as exalted as the Buddha's Nirmanakaya, so there must have been something special about the astral covering discarded by the boy Jesus that allowed it to undergo the union that rejuvenated Buddhism. In other words, a very special being must have incarnated into the body of the boy Jesus, so that rejuvenating forces radiated into his maternal astral covering during the first 12 years of his life. The being who lived and grew in the boy Jesus from birth to age 12 was no ordinary human being, but a very special being capable of radiating forces of rejuvenation into the covering that was to be discarded. To gain an idea of how it is possible for a child to affect his suprasensible coverings in such an unusual way, we can initially approach this phenomenon only through a comparison that serves to illustrate what actually happened. Individual forces that are present only as potentials in the embryo and the newborn gradually appear in the course of a normal human life. The child grows both physically and spiritually, and soul forces unfold gradually. You can read about this process in my booklet, The Education of the Child in the Light of Spiritual Science. Try to imagine the gradual internal development of emotional and intellectual forces. At ages 7, 14, and 21, forces appear that were previously absent or present to a lesser extent. Imagine what happens in the normal course of a human life. And then imagine that we experimentally alter the normal average course of development. Suppose, for example, that we do not permit this child to take in what others normally learn between the ages of 12 and 18 in the ordinary way. Instead, we provide an artificial opportunity for the child to learn with a freshness that preserves the soul's creative influence. If we want to artificially induce exceptional productivity, we cannot allow the child to grow up in the usual way. Let me emphasize that this experiment is purely hypothetical and not intended for actual implementation. I am simply using it as an example, not recommending it as an educational model. We attempt to raise this individual to be an exceptionally inventive spirit, someone who not only enlivens the human capacity for thinking, but also achieves a high level of creativity and productivity later in life. Above all else, we must prevent our experimental subject from learning the way other children learn, beginning around age 6. This child must learn as little as possible about the usual academic subjects and must be allowed to go on playing until around age 10. He may not be able to add at age 9 and may still read poorly at age 8. Such treatment allows an individual's forces to develop very differently. The soul handles what is taught very differently. In such a child, the childlike forces that are suppressed by ordinary instruction are preserved until around age 10 and are then used to understand what is taught in a very different way, making the individual's faculties especially productive. When a child is allowed to remain childlike for as long as possible, the astral covering released at puberty possesses unusually fresh youthful forces that can be perceived by clairvoyance. Such an astral covering could indeed be used by a being such as the Buddha's Nomanakaya. This experiment would not only extend childhood, but would also imbue the maternal astral covering with specific childlike or youthful forces that can then be reused to nourish and rejuvenate a being descending from spiritual heights. I do not mean to suggest that this experiment should actually be implemented. It is not a suitable model for modern education. Today we must leave certain things to the gods, so to speak, because the gods can implement them safely while human beings cannot. Occasionally, however, you hear about an individual who seemed untalented as a child and was thought to be stupid for years and years, until he or she suddenly caught on and proceeded to accomplish highly creative work in a specific field. In such cases, the gods are experimenting. They allow such individuals to remain childlike for longer than normal, and make them capable of learning only later in life. In particular, the gods experiment with children who seem alert and quick to understand, but have no interest in learning when they enter school. Something similar must have happened, and in fact did happen, but to an infinitely greater extent, to the boy Jesus, who was to provide the Buddha's Nirmanakaya with its rejuvenating mantle of maternal astrality. Such mysterious facts, which individuals may freely accept or reject, can be confirmed by anthroposophists who are prepared to receive them. If you approach these mysterious facts in the right way, and are not over hasty in judging them, you will find that they are confirmed by material facts on the physical plane, and by the contents of the Gospels or historical records. If the sources of occultists are correct, their statements, that is, the facts they derive from higher worlds and pass on to the rest of humankind, will withstand precise scrutiny. If we apply appropriate tests, we will always find such statements confirmed by what we learn in the physical world from written documents or from science. Thus the parents, described in the Luke Gospel, must have given birth to a highly exceptional child, endowed from birth with especially strong youthful or childlike forces that remained fresh and healthy in all respects as the boy grew up. This is what must have happened. Under normal circumstances, no child and no parents would have possessed the necessary forces. Under the normal circumstances prevailing among human beings of those times, it would have been impossible to find either the individuality or the parents to support such an incarnation. We must recall what our anthroposophical experience has taught us if we want to understand the very special possibilities that allowed such an incarnation to happen. We know that modern human beings evolved from the primeval human race of ancient Atlantis, which evolved in turn from the ancient Lemurians. Spiritual science discloses facts about the evolution of humankind that are very different from the facts of material science, which are based exclusively on sensory perception. Prior to our own cultural epoch, humankind passed through the Greco-Latin stage of cultural development, which was preceded by the Egypto-Chaldean, ancient Persian, and ancient Indian cultures. Earlier still, spiritual research reveals a great catastrophe that changed the entire face of the earth. Before this cataclysmic event, the extensive continent known as ancient Atlantis occupied the area that is now the Atlantic Ocean, and most of the area now inhabited by Europeans, Asians, and Africans was underwater. The great Atlantean upheaval of the earth's watery element changed the face of the earth. Before this catastrophe, most human beings lived on the Atlantean continent. As I have often described, these people were different from modern human beings. their great clairvoyant leaders and priests, foresaw the approach of the great catastrophe and guided people away from Atlantis. Most Atlanteans moved east, but some moved west and became the ancestors of Native American populations. Thus we must see the ancient Atlanteans as the forebears of modern humankind. The Atlanteans, in turn, were descended from earlier humans, who looked quite different and inhabited the continent of ancient Lemuria, which was located in the area now surrounded by Asia, Africa, and Australia. Since the details can be found in my book, An Outline of Occult Science, I will mention only the aspects that are essential to today's discussion. The Akashic record of very ancient times provides wonderful evidence that supports what we find in the Bible and other religious documents, and enables us to understand these documents correctly. For example, biblical accounts of a single human couple, Adam and Eve, supposedly the ancestors of all humanity, have been questioned by materialistic science, especially around the middle of the 19th century. This issue stimulated a great deal of scientific debate. To summarize what the Akashic record tells us, the Earth has a long prehistory. Even the Lemurian epoch was not Earth's first manifestation. Our present Earth is the re-embodiment of earlier planetary stages, Old Moon, Old Sun, and Old Saturn. Furthermore, we know that the task of the Earth's gradual evolution is to add the capital I, the fourth member of the human constitution, to the three bodies that gradually evolved during earlier embodiments of the Earth: the physical body on Saturn, the ether body on the Sun, and the astral body on the Moon. All the times that preceded the Lemurian epoch served simply to prepare for the Earth's mission. In Lemurian times, the human being first assumed a form that was capable of developing the fourth member, the eye. A seminal eye began to develop in the three members that the human being had gradually acquired. Thus we can say that changes on Earth allowed the human being to become the bearer of an eye. Even prior to Lemurian times, the Earth was populated by human beings, but they were very different from modern humans. They did not incorporate the eye, and possessed only the physical, etheric, and astral bodies that they had acquired during the Saturn, Sun, and Moon stages. The Akashic record also tells us about the cosmic events that allowed human beings to mature to this point. We know that at the beginning of its present evolutionary stage, Earth was united with the Sun and Moon. The Sun then separated from this cosmic mass, leaving behind a planetary body that combined our present Earth and Moon. We also know, however, that if Earth had remained united with the Moon, human beings would have mummified. The hardening of the human form was prevented by evicting the beings and substances belonging to the Moon. Only after the Moon's separation were human beings able to assume their present form and to become bearers of the eye. This process did not happen all at once, however. The Sun separated gradually from Earth, and even after that, human evolution could not progress as long as the Moon remained part of Earth. Physical matter became increasingly dense, and human bodies slowly hardened. The human souls of that time existed on a lower level than they do now, but were already passing through successive incarnations or embodiments, leaving material embodiment to pass through a spiritual world, and then reappearing in a new embodiment. But before the Moon's separation from Earth, certain circumstances presented obstacles to Earth's continued evolution. Some disembodied human souls that had entered the spiritual world and were attempting to reincarnate encountered physical bodies that had become too hard to receive incarnating souls. For a time, souls wanting to return to Earth could not reincarnate, because they found no suitable earthly bodies. Only the strongest souls were able to subdue the hardened physical substance they encountered and incarnate successfully on Earth. All others could not descend into bodies and had to return to the spiritual world. This situation was typical of the time before the Moon's separation. Ever fewer strong souls were able to subdue matter and populate the Earth, and there were fewer and fewer human beings on Earth because incarnating souls found no suitable bodies. What happened to the souls who could not find bodies? They were transported to the other planets that had formed from the common cosmic mass. Some souls were transported to Saturn, others to Jupiter, Mars, Venus, or Mercury. There was a long wintry period on Earth when only the strongest souls incarnated there. The weaker souls, meanwhile, were placed in the care of the other planets in our solar system. At a specific point in the Lemurian epoch, it was indeed true, or at least almost true, that only one human couple remained strong enough to subdue recalcitrant human substance and could, therefore, continue to incarnate throughout the entire Earth embodiment of our planet. At that time, however, the Moon separated from Earth, allowing human substance to become more refined and suitable for weaker human souls. Thus descendants of this single ancestral human couple were able to incarnate into substance that was softer than what had existed before the Moon's separation. Gradually all the souls that had been transported to Mars, Jupiter, Venus, and so on, returned to Earth. As the descendants of the ancestral couple multiplied, souls gradually repopulated the Earth. The time from the end of the Lemurian period until well into the Atlantean period saw the return of increasing numbers of souls who had been waiting on other planets until they could once again reincarnate in earthly bodies. These souls constituted the population of Atlantis. The Atlanteans were led by the initiates of the Atlantean oracles, great centers of guidance on the continent of Atlantis. Some were called Mars oracles, others Jupiter or Saturn oracles, and so forth. The Mars oracles provided instruction and leadership for human souls who had spent the waiting period on Mars, while the Jupiter oracles administered to those who had been on Jupiter, and so forth. During Atlantean times, the great central oracle of the sun educated only the few individuals most closely descended from the single ancestral couple that had survived the great crisis on Earth. The Bible calls these two people Adam and Eve. Thus the Akashic record confirms seemingly improbable biblical accounts. The great oracle that was known as the Sun Oracle supervised all the others and was headed by the greatest Atlantean sun initiate, Manu, who was also the leader of the Atlantean population. As the Atlantean catastrophe approached, his task was to assemble the people he found most suitable and move with them to the east, where he established a settlement that served as the source of post-Atlantean culture. He chose his associates from among the direct descendants of Adam and Eve, the ancestral souls who had survived the winter of the earth. Manu's chosen students lived in close proximity to the great initiate of the Sun Oracle, and care and attention were lavished upon them. The purpose of their instruction was to allow the right influences to flow from Manu's initiation center at all times in humankind's evolution. At certain points in time, cultures must be rejuvenated. Old traditions require a new impetus to provide human culture with a new element. This was the immediate goal of the center led by the Sun Initiate, and it could be accomplished in any number of different ways. In the earliest period of post-Atlantean cultural development, this oracle center, whose location in Asia remained a secret, supplied appropriate guidance for different cultures by sending out individuals carefully prepared to meet the needs of the respective ethnic groups. At a specific time, 5 or 6 centuries after the appearance of the great Buddha, however, it became necessary to rejuvenate Buddhism. The ancient, mature worldview, whose apex had been proclaimed by the great Buddha, needed to be immersed in a fountain of youth so that it could reappear in a fresh new form. Humankind needed an influx of specific forces of youth that did not exist in any individuality currently at work on Earth. Beings who work on behalf of the cosmos wear down their forces, that is, they grow old. If we look back in time on the development of our culture, in our development of one culture after another, first the ancient Indian culture, then the ancient Persian, then the Egypto-Chaldean, and so on, we see that in each epoch, humankind had great and important leaders who sacrificed their best forces for the progress of the human race. The great holy rishis sacrificed their best forces, as did Zarathustra, the founder of Persian culture, and Hermes, Moses, and the leaders of the Chaldean culture. All sacrificed their best forces. In terms of their influence, they were the best and most appropriate leaders for their times. For example, the soul of a personality incarnated in ancient India reappeared repeatedly, growing older and more mature as it reincarnated in the Persian and Egypto-Chaldean cultures. It acquired increasingly mature forces, but lost the fresh forces of youth. Old souls that have worked on themselves through many incarnations accomplish great deeds on behalf of humanity and teach great ideas, but they sacrifice youthful freshness and strength for the sake of this progress. Let's consider Zarathustra as an example of one of the greatest individualities to influence the course of human evolution. From the depths of the spiritual world, Zarathustra proclaimed the great tidings of the Sun Spirit, pointing his contemporaries to the great Spirit who would later appear as the Christ. Zarathustra spoke great significant words about Ahura Mazda, who dwelt in the sun and would one day come down to earth. The holy rishis had said that this being whom they called Vishvakarman existed outside their sphere, but Zarathustra called him Ahura Mazda and proclaimed his significance for human evolution. The spirit that lived in the Zarathustra body was already tremendously mature when Zarathustra founded the culture of ancient Persia. We can imagine this individuality rising ever higher and becoming older and increasingly mature and capable of greater sacrifices on humanity's behalf in subsequent incarnations. If you attended some of my other lectures, you know that Zarathustra bestowed his astral body on Hermes, the leader of Egyptian culture, and his ether body on Moses, the leader of the Hebrew people. Only the most highly evolved souls are capable of such gifts, and Zarathustra was one such individuality. 600 years before Christ, when the Buddha was active in India, the great teacher Nazarathos, or Zarathas, who taught Pythagoras, appeared in Chaldea as a later incarnation and further maturation of the great soul who led and inaugurated Persian culture. As you will see from all this, however, this soul could not rejuvenate Buddhism. Because he had achieved such great heights in the course of his incarnations, the Zarathustra being could not possibly contribute the fresh, youthful forces that typically develop before the onset of puberty. If this being had incarnated as a child at the beginning of the Christian era, that child would not have been able to develop in ways that could support the events that had become necessary. If we look at the developmental stages of all the individualities of that time, we find no one who could be born with the ability to contribute the fresh, youthful forces needed to rejuvenate Buddhism. We have just considered the uniquely great Zarathustra individuality as an example, and even he would have been unable to suitably enliven the body of Jesus until the envelope of maternal astrality was discarded and merged with the Buddha's Nirmanakaya. Where then was the great enlivening power of the Jesus body to come from? It came from the great Mother Lodge of humanity, led by the great Sun Initiate Manu, a great individual force lavished with care and attention in the great Mother Lodge, was sent down into the child who was born to the couple the Luke Gospel calls Joseph and Mary. This child received the best and strongest of the individualities fostered by the Sun Oracle. To discover who this individuality was, we must go back to a time that predates Lucifer's influence on the human astral body. Luciferic beings began to influence humanity when the earth was populated by the single couple who were the forebears of all subsequently incarnating human beings. These two individuals were strong enough to conquer human substance so that they could incarnate, but they were not strong enough to resist Lucifer's influence, which entered their astral bodies. As a result of this influence, it was not possible for all of Adam and Eve's forces to be transmitted to their blood descendants. Physical bodies had to reproduce down through the generations, but the guiding powers of humankind sequestered an aspect of the ether body. The Bible expresses this by saying that human beings, having eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that is, having tasted the consequences of the luciferic influence, had to be prevented from eating the fruit of the tree of life. This means that a certain portion of the ether body's forces were retained and not transmitted to Adam and Eve's descendants. Some of Adam's forces were taken from him after the fall, and this innocent part of Adam was preserved in the great Mother Lodge of humanity, where care and attention were lavished upon it. This aspect of Adam's soul had not been involved in events leading up to the fall, and was therefore untouched by human guilt. In it, the original forces of the Adam individuality were preserved. They were later guided into the child who was born to Joseph and Mary. During the first years of Jesus' life, the forces of the original ancestral father of humanity served as his quote-unquote provisional I, capital I. This soul had certainly remained very young. It had undergone different incarnations, but was kept at a much earlier level of development, just as we artificially attempted to hold back the child in our hypothetical educational experiment. In the infant son born to Joseph and Mary, the ancestral father of humanity, the quote-unquote old Adam, came to life as a quote-unquote new Adam. Paul was aware of this fact, which lies hidden behind the words of 1 Corinthians 15:45. The evangelist Luke, as one of Paul's students, was also aware of it, and his knowledge accounts for a rather strange turn of phrase. He knew that something special was needed to guide this spiritual substance into humankind, and that a direct blood relationship to Adam was required. That is why Luke lists Joseph's ancestry all the way back to Adam, who emerged directly from the spiritual world, and speaks of Adam as the son of God. In the Luke Gospel, the sequence of generations leads back to God. This is Luke 3:23-38. These verses, listing the ancestors of Jesus, conceal a significant mystery, namely that common blood must flow through the generations in an uninterrupted sequence to the last descendant, so that when the allotted time has passed, the spirit, too, can be guided into the last descendant. Thus the body that was born to Joseph and Mary received an infinitely youthful spirit untouched by earthly destiny, a young soul whose forces originated in ancient Lemuria. Only this spirit was strong enough to flow out completely into the maternal astral body, imbuing it with the forces it needed to merge fruitfully with the Buddha's Nirmanakaya. How then does the Luke Gospel describe Jesus of Nazareth? It first describes a human being whose blood ancestry, the line of descent of the physical body, reaches back to Adam, to the time when human life on the depopulated earth was saved by a single ancestral couple. It goes on to describe, from the perspective of reincarnation, the re-embodiment of the human soul that waited the longest to reincarnate. The Adam soul that existed before the fall appears again in the boy Jesus. As fantastical as it may sound to modern humanity, we know that the individuality guided by the great Mother Lodge of humanity into the infant Jesus was not only descended from the physically oldest generation of humans, but was also the re-embodiment of the first human being. Now we can identify the being who was presented to Simeon in the temple. When Luke called this being the quote-unquote Son of God, he was not speaking about the present human body. He was testifying that this being was the reincarnation of the oldest ancestor of the human race. Let me summarize all this briefly. 5 or 6 centuries before the beginning of the Christian era, a great bodhisattva lived in India. His mission was to bring truths to humankind, to provide the stimulus for truths that would eventually emerge from within human beings. By fulfilling his mission, he became the Buddha, and no longer needed to incarnate into an earthly body corresponding completely to his individuality. He reappeared, however, in the Nirmanakaya, the body of transformations, descending only as far as the etheric and astral worlds. The shepherds, momentarily clairvoyant, saw this being in the form of the angelic hosts who accompanied the proclamation to the shepherds. With good reason, this being inclined toward the child who was born to Joseph and Mary. Of necessity, the great Buddha's gift to humankind had appeared in a mature form. This gift was difficult to understand. It existed on an exalted level of spiritual meaning. To make it bear fruit for all of humankind, a fresh new force of youth had to flow into what the Buddha had accomplished. The Buddha had imbibed this force out of the earth by inclining over the human child, from whom he would later receive all the youthful forces of a disintegrating maternal astral body. The Buddha was more aware than anyone else that this infant's physical body could be traced back to the ancestral father of all humankind, and his soul to the soul, both old and young, of humankind during the Lemurian epoch. The Buddha recognized the child as the incarnation of the new Adam, as the mother soul of all humanity, which remained young throughout the epochs. The fresh forces of the child's life radiated into the astral body that was released at puberty and rose to merge with the Buddha's Nirmanakaya. These are only some of the facts that allow us to understand the wonderful mystery of Palestine. Now we can identify the being who was born in Bethlehem after Joseph and Mary traveled there from Nazareth. We know whose coming was announced by the shepherds. This, however, is only one aspect of the story. The beginning of the Christian era was full of strange and significant happenings leading to the greatest event in humankind's evolution. We must consider other aspects in order to understand what gradually led to this great event. Among the ancient Hebrews, all those, quote, of the house and lineage of David, unquote, were descended from a common ancestor, David. The Bible tells us that David had two sons, Solomon and Nathan. That's Samuel, second book of Samuel 5:14. Two lines of descent, the Solomonic line and the Nathanic line, counted David as their common ancestor. Ignoring the intermediary links, we can say that descendants of both the Solomonic and Nathanic lines lived in Palestine at the beginning of our era. One descendant of the Nathanic branch of the house of David was a man named Joseph, a native of Nazareth. His wife's name was Mary. Surprisingly enough, a native of Bethlehem descended from the Solomonic branch was also named Joseph, and he too was married to a woman named Mary. Thus, at the beginning of the Christian era, there were two couples named Joseph and Mary living in Palestine. One couple was descended from the Solomonic branch of the house of David, that is, from the kingly lineage, while the other couple in Nazareth were descendants of the Nathanic or priestly branch. The child I described yesterday and today, the child who supplied the maternal astral body that was absorbed into the Buddha's Nirmanakaya, was born to the couple of Nathanic descent. As that child's birth approached, his parents, the Nathanic couple, left Nazareth to go to Bethlehem, quote, to be enrolled, unquote, as Luke says, Luke 2:4-5. The other couple, not originally from Nazareth, we must take the Gospels literally, lived in Bethlehem as described by the author of the Matthew Gospel, Matthew 2:1. The Gospels always tell the truth. There are no conundrums to be solved. Through anthroposophy, people will again begin to take the Gospels literally. A son, also named Jesus, was born to this Solomonic couple, and his body also supported the incarnation of a mighty individuality. The task of this child, so profound is the wisdom of the cosmos, was not to supply a maternal astral body with fresh, youthful forces, but rather to bestow the gifts of a mature soul on humankind. All of the relevant forces guided this child to become the incarnation of the individuality who once taught about Ahura Mazda in Persia, the individuality who gave his astral body to Hermes and his ether body to Moses. This being who reappeared as Zarathos or Nazarathos, the great Chaldean teacher of Pythagoras, is none other than the Zarathustra individuality. The I-being of Zarathustra was reincarnated in the child who was born, as the Matthew Gospel tells us, to a couple named Joseph and Mary, natives of Bethlehem, who belonged to the kingly or Solomonic branch of the house of David. As you see, we find part of the truth in Matthew and the other part in Luke. We must take them both literally, because the truth of the cosmos is complicated. Now we can identify the individuality who was born into the priestly branch of the house of David. But we also know that the individuality once active in Persia as Zarathustra, the founder of the royal magic of Persia, was born into the kingly branch. Thus these two individualities led parallel lives, the young Adam individuality in the child belonging to the priestly branch of the house of David, and the Zarathustra individuality in the child of kingly descent. Tomorrow we will learn more about how and why this all happened, and about further events in Palestine. End of this lecture 4, given in Basel, September 18th, 1909.